Escuelas oficiales de idiomas de Andalucía. Inglés. C1. Comprensión oral. Tarea 1. Escuche la grabación. Elija la mejor opción. A, B o C. El texto se escuchará 3 veces. Ahora dispone usted de 2 minutos para leer las preguntas.
Where does the idea of free speech come from? And does it cover the content of a magazine like Charlie Hebdo, whose stock in trade is outrage and offence? In Western liberal democracies, free speech has long been seen as essential to robust political debate, but its origins lie in conflict over religious differences some 400 years ago. Sam Nelson is the author of Beyond the First Amendment, The Politics of Free Speech and Pluralism.
Free speech really, in Western liberal democracies anyway, really starts during the English Civil War, which was a religious civil war. So what's interesting here, I think, in many ways, is that religious speech and speech about religion has always been central to the origins of freedom of speech and the theories that we have for which speech should be protected, how it works, and all of those things. So really, I would say the earliest arguments that we see in liberal democracies, about 400 years old, stemming from those early religious toleration debates and the subject of religious freedom.
How did the free speech concept fit in with freedom of religion?
I think one of the main goals was to avoid having further religious wars. How can we alleviate some of the violence that comes from people's religious differences and differences of opinion about religion? Based on the idea that those differences were fairly intractable, that you weren't going to eliminate them by getting everybody to agree, so how could you deal with the fact of disagreement or the fact of argumentation about those things?
At what point was the concept of free speech first embodied legally? Was it set down in law somewhere?
It is set down in law, and it dates to different periods in different countries and different constitutional structures and things like that. One of the key things about when free speech starts to be enshrined in law is that it's extremely limited protection. Most kinds of speech wouldn't really have been protected, and it develops in, I don't think, a formal way where somebody says, oh, here's the free speech bill, and now we're going to protect free speech when we didn't before. I think expectations about speech being protected or discussion and deliberation being protected develop over time. An example that I use in my classes a lot during the colonial period in the United States, people had an expectation that they had freedom of speech. It didn't look very much like what we take for granted today, but they could still face corporal punishments for libel and slander, for instance. They would cut off the top of people's ears for libel or pierce their tongue with a red-hot poker for slander, even though they understood themselves to have freedom of speech. It wasn't protected to the extent that they could do whatever they wanted.
From the 17th century through the Age of Enlightenment and into the 19th century through influential writers such as John Stuart Mill, the centrality of freedom of speech to democracy and even to freedom itself evolved as a core value in Western democracies. While governments have always set limits on speech with laws on libel, obscenity, and so on, in 1948, the United Nations recognized the right to freedom of expression in its Universal Declaration of Human Rights. But during the last half of the 20th century, new limits to free speech have become enshrined in law. Professor Simon Rice from the ANU College of Law in Canberra.
I think there's been a change of sensibilities. You can track it. A lot of the limits on free speech for a long time were limits that were designed to protect property, and I mean property in a broad sense, including reputation, so defamation laws. In the second half of the 20th century, there was a greater awareness of perhaps the need to protect people who are vulnerable. Rather than protecting property owners and reputation, we could also extend to protect people who weren't able to actually protect themselves. For example, I think of the consumer protection laws in that way. Consumer protection laws now tell corporations that there are limits on representations they can make. So their freedom of speech, their freedom of expression is limited when it comes to promoting qualities of their products. That kind of limitation that protects vulnerable, in that case consumers, I think is the same sensibility that protects people who are vulnerable because of their race. For a long time, it didn't trouble us to say what we liked about people because of their race. In fact, notoriously in Australia, we made race a very public issue and we prided ourselves on having a very limited and bigoted view of race. But that has obviously changed and probably turned around 180 degrees, where we're now much more sensitive to protecting people's sensibilities because of race.
Ahora dispone usted de un minuto para comprobar sus respuestas.
Where does the idea of free speech come from? And does it cover the content of a magazine like Charlie Hebdo, whose stock in trade is outrage and offence? In Western liberal democracies, free speech has long been seen as essential to robust political debate, but its origins lie in conflict over religious differences some 400 years ago. Sam Nelson is the author of Beyond the First Amendment, The Politics of Free Speech and Pluralism.
Free speech really, in Western liberal democracies anyway, really starts during the English Civil War, which was a religious civil war. So what's interesting here, I think, in many ways, is that religious speech and speech about religion has always been central to the origins of freedom of speech and the theories that we have for which speech should be protected, how it works, and all of those things. So really, I would say the earliest arguments that we see in liberal democracies, about 400 years old, stemming from those early religious toleration debates and the subject of religious freedom.
How did the free speech concept fit in with freedom of religion?
I think one of the main goals was to avoid having further religious wars. How can we alleviate some of the violence that comes from people's religious differences and differences of opinion about religion, based on the idea that those differences were fairly intractable, that you weren't going to eliminate them by getting everybody to agree? So how could you deal with the fact of disagreement or the fact of argumentation about those things?
At what point was the concept of free speech first embodied legally? Was it set down in law somewhere?
It is set down in law, and it dates to different periods in different countries and different constitutional structures and things like that. One of the key things about when free speech starts to be enshrined in law is that it's extremely limited protection. Most kinds of speech wouldn't really have been protected, and it develops in, I don't think, a formal way where somebody says, oh, here's the free speech bill, and now we're going to protect free speech when we didn't before. I think expectations about speech being protected or discussion and deliberation being protected develop over time. An example that I use in my classes a lot during the colonial period in the United States, people had an expectation that they had freedom of speech. It didn't look very much like what we take for granted today, but they could still face corporal punishments for libel and slander, for instance. They would cut off the top of people's ears for libel or pierce their tongue with a red-hot poker for slander, even though they understood themselves to have freedom of speech. It wasn't protected to the extent that they could do whatever they wanted.
From the 17th century through the Age of Enlightenment and into the 19th century through influential writers such as John Stuart Mill, the centrality of freedom of speech to democracy and even to freedom itself evolved as a core value in Western democracies. While governments have always set limits on speech with laws on libel, obscenity, and so on, in 1948, the United Nations recognized the right to freedom of expression in its Universal Declaration of Human Rights. But during the last half of the 20th century, new limits to free speech have become enshrined in law. Professor Simon Rice from the ANU College of Law in Canberra.
I think there's been a change of sensibilities. You can track it. A lot of the limits on free speech for a long time were limits that were designed to protect property, and I mean property in a broad sense, including reputation, so defamation laws. In the second half of the 20th century, there was a greater awareness of perhaps the need to protect people who are vulnerable. Rather than protecting property owners and reputation, we could also extend to protect people who weren't able to actually protect themselves. For example, I think of the consumer protection laws in that way. Consumer protection laws now tell corporations that there are limits on representations they can make. So their freedom of speech, their freedom of expression is limited when it comes to promoting qualities of their products. That kind of limitation that protects vulnerable, in that case consumers, I think is the same sensibility that protects people who are vulnerable because of their race. For a long time, it didn't trouble us to say what we liked about people because of their race. In fact, notoriously in Australia, we made race a very public issue, and we prided ourselves on having a very limited and bigoted view of race. But that has obviously changed and probably turned around 180 degrees, where we're now much more sensitive to protecting people's sensibilities because of race.
Ahora dispone usted de un minuto para comprobar sus respuestas.
Where does the idea of free speech come from? And does it cover the content of a magazine like Charlie Hebdo, whose stock in trade is outrage and offence? In Western liberal democracies, free speech has long been seen as essential to robust political debate, but its origins lie in conflict over religious differences some 400 years ago. Sam Nelson is the author of Beyond the First Amendment, The Politics of Free Speech and Pluralism.
Free speech really, in Western liberal democracies anyway, really starts during the English Civil War, which was a religious civil war. So what's interesting here, I think, in many ways, is that religious speech and speech about religion has always been central to the origins of freedom of speech and the theories that we have for which speech should be protected, how it works, and all of those things. So really, I would say the earliest arguments that we see in liberal democracies, about 400 years old, stemming from those early religious toleration debates and the subject of religious freedom.
How did the free speech concept fit in with freedom of religion?
I think one of the main goals was to avoid having further religious wars. How can we alleviate some of the violence that comes from people's religious differences and differences of opinion about religion? Based on the idea that those differences were fairly intractable, that you weren't going to eliminate them by getting everybody to agree. So how could you deal with the fact of disagreement or the fact of argumentation about those things?
At what point was the concept of free speech first embodied legally? Was it set down in law somewhere?
It is set down in law, and it dates to different periods in different countries and different constitutional structures and things like that. One of the key things about when free speech starts to be enshrined in law is that it's extremely limited protection. Most kinds of speech wouldn't really have been protected, and it develops in, I don't think, a formal way where somebody says, oh, here's the free speech bill, and now we're going to protect free speech when we didn't before. I think expectations about speech being protected or discussion and deliberation being protected develop over time. An example that I use in my classes a lot during the colonial period in the United States, people had an expectation that they had freedom of speech. It didn't look very much like what we take for granted today, but they could still face corporal punishments for libel and slander, for instance. They would cut off the top of people's ears for libel or pierce their tongue with a red-hot poker for slander, even though they understood themselves to have freedom of speech. It wasn't protected to the extent that they could do whatever they wanted.
From the 17th century through the Age of Enlightenment and into the 19th century through influential writers such as John Stuart Mill, the centrality of freedom of speech to democracy and even to freedom itself evolved as a core value in Western democracies. While governments have always set limits on speech with laws on libel, obscenity, and so on, in 1948, the United Nations recognized the right to freedom of expression in its Universal Declaration of Human Rights. But during the last half of the 20th century, new limits to free speech have become enshrined in law. Professor Simon Rice from the ANU College of Law in Canberra.
I think there's been a change of sensibilities. You can track it. A lot of the limits on free speech for a long time were limits that were designed to protect property, and I mean property in a broad sense, including reputation, so defamation laws. In the second half of the 20th century, there was a greater awareness of perhaps the need to protect people who are vulnerable. Rather than protecting property owners and reputation, we could also extend to protect people who weren't able to actually protect themselves. For example, I think of the consumer protection laws in that way. Consumer protection laws now tell corporations that there are limits on representations they can make. So their freedom of speech, their freedom of expression is limited when it comes to promoting qualities of their products. That kind of limitation that protects vulnerable, in that case consumers, I think is the same sensibility that protects people who are vulnerable because of their race. For a long time, it didn't trouble us to say what we liked about people because of their race. In fact, notoriously in Australia, we made race a very public issue, and we prided ourselves on having a very limited and bigoted view of race. But that has obviously changed and probably turned around 180 degrees, where we're now much more sensitive to protecting people's sensibilities because of race.
Ahora dispone usted de un minuto para comprobar sus respuestas. Este es el final de la tarea 1. Tarea 2. Escuche la grabación. Indique sus respuestas en la casilla correspondiente. El texto se escuchará 3 veces. Ahora dispone usted de 2 minutos para leer las preguntas.
Extract 1.
The ones I call the terrible triplets are the World Bank, the International Monetary Fund, IMF, and the World Trade Organization. And I call them the terrible triplets, but I could call them the World Ministry of Trade and Finance, because we do have a world ministry there. We don't have a world ministry of health. We don't have a world ministry of education. We don't have a world ministry for any of the good things that ought to be done. But we do have these bodies which, in the case of the bank and the fund, can't dictate to Britain or to France, although they do make remarks and they do make periodic surveys of all of our countries, but they can dictate to poorer and weaker countries. So that is a real ministry.
Extract 2.
And the WTO has a mechanism called the Dispute Resolution Body, which is able to resolve trade disputes, and it has clout because it can authorize sanctions, which can be used against the rich, although the poor don't really have an opportunity to sanction the rich very much, because although, for instance, Guatemala won a case against the United States, what a sanction is, it means that this dispute resolution body can tell Guatemala, you can put 100% tax on the American goods that you import of your choice, and thereby make the goods more expensive. But how much is that going to hurt the U.S.? What's Guatemala's imports of U.S. goods really going to do them? If it were a much larger economy, yes, that could cause definite pain and suffering. And
Extract 3.
In Europe, for instance, where we are still paying every year $116 million in raised tariffs on certain farm products from Europe to the U.S. because we're refusing to import hormone-fed beef. So the WTO said this is unfair competition, and authorized Europe to raise tariffs on U.S. goods to the amount of $4.5 billion, And we have never done that because the U.S. keeps saying, yes, yes, we're going to change the legislation, just give us a little more time. And it's been, I forget how long, but 3 or 4 years now, and still nothing has happened. So there are degrees of how much these institutions can actually impose in the way of rules.
Extract 4.
But I think most of their rules are completely unfair. Let's not forget that it's the WTO that is trying to privatize and commoditize every human activity, all of the services, all of health and education, all of public services, transport, energy, water, etc. And they've also raised the stakes on patents so that you get protection for 20 years, which means there's less transfer of technology to the poorer countries. So I think most of these rules are very bad. I could go on and on about what they are. So I think we definitely need to focus on those rules that have been made and say these are very bad rules if we are going to determine what is a good rule by what it does to ordinary people. Is this a help or a hindrance to their lives?
Extract 5.
I have in particular focused myself more recently on the WTO and on the services agreement, because I think that this is hugely unfair. And now that those talks are stalled or stalemated anyway for the next several months, Europe and the United States are trying to get the same things, but in spades, going through bilateral or plurilateral talks. So we have a long way to go, and we're not near making any rules which would ensure that social justice became the norm, because that would mean that we would have something like a welfare state, a taxation and redistribution system.
Ahora dispone usted de un minuto para comprobar sus respuestas.
Extract 1.
The ones I call the terrible triplets are the World Bank, the International Monetary Fund, IMF, and the World Trade Organization. And I call them the terrible triplets, but I could call them the World Ministry of Trade and Finance, because we do have a world ministry there. We don't have a world ministry of health. We don't have a world ministry of education. We don't have a world ministry for any of the good things that ought to be done. But we do have these bodies which, in the case of the bank and the fund, can't dictate to Britain or to France, although they do make remarks and they do make periodic surveys of all of our countries, but they can dictate to poorer and weaker countries. So that is a real ministry.
Extract 2.
And the WTO has a mechanism called the Dispute Resolution Body, which is able to resolve trade disputes, and it has clout because it can authorize sanctions, which can be used against the rich, although the poor don't really have an opportunity to sanction the rich very much, because although, for instance, Guatemala won a case against the United States, what a sanction is. It means that this dispute resolution body can tell Guatemala, you can put 100% tax on the American goods that you import of your choice, and thereby make the goods more expensive. But how much is that going to hurt the U.S.? What's Guatemala's imports of U.S. goods really going to do? That if it were a much larger economy, yes, that could cause definite pain and suffering. And
Extract 3.
In Europe, for instance, where we are still paying every year $116 million in raised tariffs on certain farm products from Europe to the U.S. because we're refusing to import hormone-fed beef. So the WTO said this is unfair competition and authorized Europe to raise tariffs on U.S. goods to the amount of $4.5 billion, and we have never done that because the U.S. keeps saying, yes, yes, we're going to change the legislation, just give us a little more time. And it's been, I forget how long, but 3 or 4 years now, and still nothing has happened. So there are degrees of how much these institutions can actually impose in the way of rules.
Extract 4.
But I think most of their rules are completely unfair. Let's not forget that it's the WTO that is trying to privatize and commoditize every human activity, all of the services, all of health and education, all of public services, transport, energy, water, etc. And they've also raised the stakes on patents, so that you get protection for 20 years, which means there's less transfer of technology to the poorer countries. So I think most of these rules are very bad. I could go on and on about what they are. So I think we definitely need to focus on those rules that have been made and say these are very bad rules if we are going to determine what is a good rule by what it does to ordinary people. Is this a help or a hindrance to their lives?
Extract 5.
I have in particular focused myself more recently on the WTO and on the services agreement because I think that this is hugely unfair. And now that those talks are stalled or stalemated anyway for the next several months, well, Europe and the United States are trying to get the same things, but in spades, going through bilateral or plurilateral talks. So we have a long way to go, and we're not near making any rules which would ensure that social justice became the norm, because that would mean that we would have something like a welfare state, a taxation and redistribution system.
Ahora dispone usted de un minuto para comprobar sus respuestas.
Extract 1.
The ones I call the terrible triplets are the World Bank, the International Monetary Fund, IMF, and the World Trade Organization. And I call them the terrible triplets, but I could call them the World Ministry of Trade and Finance, because we do have a world ministry there. We don't have a world ministry of health. We don't have a world ministry of education. We don't have a world ministry for any of the good things that ought to be done. But we do have these bodies which, in the case of the bank and the fund, can't dictate to Britain or to France, although they do make remarks and they do make periodic surveys of all of our countries, but they can dictate to poorer and weaker countries. So that is a real ministry.
Extract 2.
And the WTO has a mechanism called the Dispute Resolution Body, which is able to resolve trade disputes, and it has clout because it can authorize sanctions, which can be used against the rich, although the poor don't really have an opportunity to sanction the rich very much, because although, for instance, Guatemala won a case against the United States, what a sanction is, it means that this dispute resolution body can tell Guatemala, you can put 100% tax on the American goods that you import of your choice, and thereby make the goods more expensive. But how much is that going to hurt the U.S.? What's Guatemala's imports of U.S. goods really going to do? That? If it were a much larger economy, yes, that could cause definite pain and suffering. And
Extract 3.
In Europe, for instance, where we are still paying every year $116 million in raised tariffs on certain farm products from Europe to the U.S. because we're refusing to import hormone-fed beef. So the WTO said this is unfair competition and authorized Europe to raise tariffs on U.S. goods to the amount of $4.5 billion, and we have never done that. Because the U.S. keeps saying, yes, yes, we're going to change the legislation, just give us a little more time. And it's been, I forget how long, but 3 or 4 years now, and still nothing has happened. So there are degrees of how much these institutions can actually impose in the way of rules.
Extract 4.
But I think most of their rules are completely unfair. Let's not forget that it's the WTO that is trying to privatize and commoditize every human activity, all of the services, all of health and education, all of public services, transport, energy, water, etc. And they've also raised the stakes on patents, so that you get protection for 20 years, which means there's less transfer of technology to the poorer countries. So I think most of these rules are very bad. I could go on and on about what they are. So I think we definitely need to focus on those rules that have been made and say these are very bad rules if we are going to determine what is a good rule by what it does to ordinary people. Is this a help or a hindrance to their lives?
Extract 5.
I have in particular focused myself more recently on the WTO and on the services agreement, because I think that this is hugely unfair. And now that those talks are stalled or stalemated anyway for the next several months, well, Europe and the United States are trying to get the same things, but in spades, going through bilateral or plurilateral talks. So we have a long way to go, and we're not near making any rules which would ensure that social justice became the norm, because that would mean that we would have something like a welfare state, a taxation and redistribution system.
Ahora dispone usted de un minuto para comprobar sus respuestas. Este es el final de la tarea 2.